morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we are going to be speaking with poets Gerald Stern and Anne-Marie Macari. Right now, I would like to welcome Dillis Evans. She's the author of the book Show and Tell, Exploring the Fine Art of Children's Book Illustration, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe this Friday, the 16th of May at 5:30 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this is a book about, as the title tells us, children's book illustration as a fine art. Book illustrators usually don't get the attention. How did you get the idea to do this book showcasing the illustrators?
Well, I guess it started way back in the 70s when I was an art director for Cricket Magazine, a magazine for children. And we were probably in the second or third issue, and I began to discover a whole world of children's book illustration that I really didn't know very well before. And having trained as a fine artist and had shows and exhibitions in New York City, I suddenly found a whole new area to be passionate about, and I decided to do some research and got to love it.
I remember so many books from my childhood, and one of them is the first artist whom you talk about in the book. The first chapter is about Hillary Knight, and Hillary Knight's ABC book was the book from which I learned the alphabet. And also, he did that great series of books called Eloise. Tell us about him.
Well, Hillary Knight, as a matter of fact, yesterday called me from New York to say he'd just gotten his copy of the book and to say how pleased he was and delighted to be a part of it. He's a little older than he used to be, but we don't talk about age, Hillary and I, because he's ageless.
He is ageless. These books are incredible.
They are, and his sense of humor is wonderful. And he first got the idea to do Eloise because he met Kay Thompson, introduced by Dee Dee Dixon in New York. And Kay Thompson was a cabaret singer. And she had a character called Eloise, who she would use sometimes to answer her telephone in her apartment. If she wanted to sort of not exactly be serious on the telephone, she would put in Eloise to help her out. And she wanted to do a book about her, so she talked to Hillary about doing that, and he became intrigued, and that's how the series started, and the first book was published in 1955.
Tell us about the character of Eloise. I mean, the amazing thing about book illustrators is that they can bring people and animals and houses and everything to a kind of aliveness that's spectacular.
Well, it's interesting in Hillary's case because he had just discovered the art of Ronald Searle and all those wonderful English books about English children and especially girls in boarding schools and the kinds of things they got up to. So he decided to use a technique very much based on that idea, although his drawings are very different. And so Eloise had to be this naughty little girl who owned the Plaza Hotel where she in fact lived, and he chose a vertical size for the book so that he could do the verticality of the hotel and have long shots of the stories of how big the hotel is and the stairways, and had a great deal of fun doing it, and of course ended up doing, I think, three or four books after that.
One of the things that I noticed about your book is that it seems to kind of be for other artists as much as anything. You talk about the materials that they use and things that probably interest artists or that artists know about more than the general public.
I love this question. When I was at Cricket Magazine, probably after about 4 or 5 years, I began to realize that when I read reviews of children's picture books, so much more was talking about the story, and there was very little description of the artwork. And in fact, one day I read a piece that said that this 32-page picture book, which was indeed a picture book, it had one line of text on each page, which is appropriate, actually, absolutely right for children of that age, because they are learning to read. And it said, of this beautiful 32-page picture book with full-color art on every page, after a long half a page description of the story, pretty little watercolors accompany the text. And right then and there, I said, oh, I've got to write a book explaining that this is a fine art form, and the art in children's picture books is very special. So some 30 years later, when I finally am semi-retired, I had the time to put this together, and I chose 12 totally different illustrators, all of whom are very spectacular in the way they do their work in different ways, whether it's quietly or with great effort, to just illustrate 12 different approaches to illustration, and to talk about the media in terms that teachers, art directors, critics, writers of children's book critiques could use this information to talk about the style, the composition, the color, the technique, all very different, and the scope that they'll find in illustration in children's books today.
When you have a situation like Hillary Knight and Kay Thompson, who wrote Eloise, and there are many other examples of this too, there has to be a special chemistry and collaboration between the artist and the writer.
I think, as Hillary explains it, that he loved her work as a singer. He knew it because he was very interested in the theater. And they clicked immediately. They had a great deal in common. And so he was delighted to have this opportunity, and they remained very good working friends throughout the entire series.
An artist who's illustrating children's books has to keep a childlike sensibility in their lives, I suppose, in order to be good at it.
Well, that's true. And also there's the whole skill of the humorous children's books. I mean, they go from slapstick to very complex, sly humor. So, you know, there has to be a huge range in terms of an artist's background. And that's why when you look at all these 12 illustrators, you'll see how they change from one thing to another. How Paul Zielinski, for example, can go from Italian Renaissance to The Wheels on the Bus and all the funny little books that he does as well. Enormous range in his abilities.
Well, that's the other thing. In other words, when they come to a new author and a new story, sometimes their style changes to the point where you're not sure if it's even the same artist.
Well, that's the wonder of illustration, where I have a program that I do called The 10 Principles of Illustrating a Great Picture Book. And the first one is, in the beginning is the word. And the illustrator must read the manuscript first and absolutely love it before taking it on, absolutely see the art as they're doing the work. So there's a great deal that goes into the decision making about which stories you should or should not accept. And when I was I had Dillis Evans Fine Illustration Agency in New York and represented some 30 illustrators, I would get manuscripts from publishers on my desk, and they'd say, well, this is perfect for David Wiesner or Betsy Lewin or whatever, and please have them read it and get back to me. And I would read the manuscript first, send it to the illustrator, and then wait to see what the illustrator said. And after working with all of my people, they knew better than to say, well, what do you think? Because I'd never answer the question. I'd say, tell me how you felt when you read the story. And I've had instances where I've had a phone call back saying, I absolutely love this story. I can see the pictures. I want to do it. And that happened in Betsy Lewin's case in Cows That Type by Doreen Cronin.
Now,
and
Cows
it's gone
That
on to be
Type.
A great winner.
I know. I mean, I'd never seen that book when I was a kid. I'm not sure when it came out, but it's about cows who learn to use a typewriter. I mean, your book makes one want to go back to all these children's books and read them.
Well, they're very funny and wise and dear, and they do make you laugh. I mean, they get to the adults as well as the children, because the humor is really subtle and funny and in many ways quite complex. So it amuses the parent as well as the child. And in the case of Click, Clack, Moo, Cows That Type, Doreen Cronin was a lawyer, and this was her first children's book. And so for her, it was a huge dive into the world of children's books. And the book went on to win a Silver Caldecott Medal and has gone into many different printings, has sold to many different countries, videos. I believe there's a movie contract in the works. Lots of different things are happening. But the book itself is funny, because the whole premise is one day the cows find a typewriter in the barn. And they really are sort of bored with the everyday routine, and they decide that they would like electric blankets because it's cold in the barn at night, and they type a note to Farmer Brown to that effect. And the whole thing is this back and forth between the two, and it's very, very funny.
We're talking to Dillis Evans. The book is called Show and Tell, Exploring the Fine Art of Children's Book Illustration, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore this Friday, May 16th at 5:30 in the afternoon. Some of the illustrators are themselves also the storytellers. Dr. Seuss, of course, is my probably favorite of the storyteller artist genre, but you have some others. Do those people, David Wiesner is one of them, do those people start also with the story? In the beginning there's the word and then they illustrate it? Or do they sometimes start with the pictures?
That's a very good question, because very often there are illustrators who've always written stories. My best experience has been with David Wiesner, a young illustrator who I first took on in, I guess it was 1979 in New York City. He had just graduated from RISD, the Rhode Island School of Design, and he came to me with a portfolio. And I'd actually seen his work at Cricut. We gave him a cover to do when I was at Cricut magazine, so I did know a few of his things, but not really who he was. And when I saw his portfolio, the first image I saw was a brownstone building in the village. Third-story window was wide open, and this enormous fish was just floating out of the third-story window into the sky. And life was going on as usual below. Nobody paid it any attention. And I looked at this and I thought, imagination. This guy is a genius. And after then turning a page and seeing a field with about 100 small Lilliputian characters holding onto ropes that were supporting a big green pepper in the sky, I knew that this young man was made to do children's book illustration. And in fact, I took him on, and in the course of 29 years representing him, he's won 3 gold medals, 2 silver medals, many other isolated awards in the children's book field, and last year represented the United States for the Hans Christian Andersen Award and reached the final, actually. So he's a remarkable young man, and his imagery comes to him in story form, and yet he visualizes, he does it all in pictures without any words at all. He's written a couple of things as an aside, but not anything that's really been a major impact on the field the way his wordless picture books have been. And he is known as David Wiesner, who visualizes stories. And his latest book, Flotsam, which won a gold Caldecott medal the year before this year, is about an underwater journey of a camera, and it's absolutely fascinating, and you might look for it when you go to a bookstore.
You have been doing children's books for so long. How have they changed, if they have, as media have changed and as times have changed?
That's a question that would probably take a long time to fully answer, but perhaps I can say that they've changed as the current illustrators have grown up in a very different world from children before them. And I was speaking at Vassar once at a conference that I did for a couple of years in the summer, a publishing conference. And I had this young woman who was insisting she could do a children's book because she was still a child. She knew what it was like. She remembered. And finally, I had to say to her, well, you know, you're much older, and it's very difficult to completely be in that childhood space because children now are very different. And she said, no, I really understand. So then I had to challenge her, and I said, so you know what it was like to grow up pushing a light switch on and off, and you knew about digital time, and you know, you by 3 you were on the computer. And she said, well, we didn't have computers then, and we didn't have lights. And I said, I rest my case. You know, it's a whole other world, technically speaking, and from an opportunity point of view. And the children today, they're much faster in their recognition. They're very, very smart. And they have a definite point of view. And I'm not saying that they're better than we were. Of course, no one could be better than we were.
Of course.
But it's an interesting thing. And I know when I look at comics or when I look at videos, and especially some of the newer material that's coming out, the images, the screen is so full of action constantly. It's going so fast that children don't seem to have any problem with all of that. I find myself really having to focus and not miss something. So I can't quite describe what that is yet, but yes, there's a change, there's a difference. Although there will always be classic children's books because they're retelling classic stories that don't change.
Well, when you have, for example, you know, in TV or movie or video media, whatever, very quickly cut images and huge amounts of stimulation, and these children can get it and so on. On a book, you can't do that. The illustrations are still, and it's one page that you look at and you turn, and you can't turn the pages any faster than you could in, you know, 1955 or whatever. So, I mean, are children's books in some way responding to new media?
Well, they are in words of tech, in from the point of view of technique. There are now digital books. There are books where completely made up on the computer. The visual images are made on the computer, and they end up being picture books. And in my book, Lane Smith is a good example of that. And I think that the challenge here is that the design of the book is sometimes a little different. In David Wiesner's book Tuesday about flying frogs, which also won a Caldecott Gold, there's a whole sequential things about the journeys of the frogs back going back to their original pond towards the end of the book. And Wiesner has used graphic rectangles to do sort of stepping stones, almost like a picture kind of thing, movie kind of thing. And so different ideas emerge like that, I think. That's a difference. And also very bright colors, a huge pastiche of technique in terms of collage in some books. So it's there are very many, there's a very different look in terms of some of the new ways of doing children's books. But basically, there's such a grand history which needs to be continued, and it is continuing.
Parents often read these books to their children, and parents often choose these books for their children. And so these, whatever art and whatever stories, have to appeal just as much to parents as to children, I suppose.
Well, very often that's the case in terms of parents who haven't had a lot of background of books. The best thing in this case is always to go to the library and talk to the children's librarian, or to a bookstore that really has a lot of children's books and talk to the person who's ordering children's books. And of course, school is the big emphasis in terms of what's available, what's good, what's bad. But yes, parents usually do choose the books, although kids, when they get to a certain age, going to a bookstore, they get to know certain artists or pictures or stories, and they're looking for more of the same. And so that comes into the picture as well.
And there is, you talk in your book about the importance of black and white line drawings, and I think probably many of us who grew up on Winnie the Pooh remember how important and how vivid those are. I mean, I think some of those images of Winnie the Pooh are engraved, and Piglet and so on, are engraved on the inside of on your mind forever.
Yes, that's true. And I should say, going back to Hilary Knight, that Eloise at the Plaza was not a full-color picture book. It was black and white drawings with the colors red and black then superimposed in layers and printed. So that they didn't have the benefit of full-color printing for all children's books.
And yellow,
it's so
too,
expensive.
No?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, little bits of splashes of, yeah. But each book changed the Hilary series. There was a little more color that went along. And the other thing about Hilary Knight is because of his interest in the theater, he did a great many Broadway posters and was well-known on Broadway because he went to the theater a great deal. And some of his books, you'll see that he almost creates a scenario, a stage, especially the Little Rabbit poem, which is on two pages, where there's almost like a proscenium, and the mother rabbit's on the top and the stage is below, and you feel like you're the audience looking at the story.
Do some of the artists do both children's book illustration and, for example, fine art that's shown in galleries or whatever?
There must be some who do. I don't know very many who do that, because they're so involved with their own art form as a fine art form that that's their life. And for them, it really is visualizing the printed word, or visualizing an intellectual idea, rather than taking a huge canvas and creating something. And David Wiesner was painting in art school, and he made the discovery that, in fact, he really did want to tell stories, and he really didn't just want to do one piece and have it hanging on a wall. You know, he wanted to do more than that. And different reasons for every artist, of course, but most of these people, what they do are children's book illustration, or posters, or magazine illustrations occasionally, or covers for YA books, young adult novels. So there are different ways that they use their art.
Another thing that some of them have to do is be able to scare people.
Yes, well, that's the funny, scary boo rather than a horrific thing that you see in the movies. And humor is a wonderful kind of book to do, because you have so many opportunities. And David Shannon is great at that, and Betsy Lewin is great at that. And David Shannon's book, Duck on a Bike, which I show a picture of in my book, there's a wonderful scene where Duck is charging out of the barnyard, chasing a chicken. And as you open it, the chicken looks as though it's coming right into your lap because it's so well designed. And then when you look at Duck and he's on the bike and he's holding the handlebars and his foot is down on the pedal, you realize that you think he's a duck. How can he, you know, you're looking at the handlebars and then you see on the pedal that his little foot is curved around the edge of the pedal holding on. Little touches like that that make you feel it's real. And another incident of No David, which is a series of books by David Shannon, both wrote and illustrated. He's standing in the living room with a baseball bat, and he's got a baseball hat on, and he's just about to hit this ball in the living room. And when you look, you can see that if you follow where the bat will go, it wipes out everything on the coffee table, and the whole scene is set up for both fun and danger. The whole wall is painted red in the back to tell you something bad's going to happen. But he doesn't do the end result. He does just before it's going to happen, and they can all say, oh no! They all can cry out and see what's going to happen, the aftermath. And that's better than just doing a mess and saying, look what this little boy did with his baseball bat.
Right. You know? Yeah.
So there's the genius of deciding the best part to illustrate.
Right. And that's true to life in any child's life, is that there's always this moment before the disaster that you're aware of.
Exactly. And in Cows That Type, there's a scene where the cows are not getting what they want from Farmer Brown, so they go on strike, and they put a typed note on the barn door that says, "Sorry, closed, no milk today." And on one page you see of the gutter of the book, you see four cows looking around the corner to see Farmer Brown's reaction. On the other, you see the red barn door and the shadow of Farmer Brown, huge in by comparison, where he's jumping in the air and his hair stands on end and he's obviously screaming as he's reading the note. Instead of showing him from the front and his facial reaction, the illustrator realized they had to show why he was upset. So they had to show the note on the barn and Farmer Brown. So Betsy Lewin decided to do it from the back, because if he's jumping and huge, his shadow will be much more scary. And so that was a definite humor decision, and it's much funnier that way.
Well, and some of it is not humorous. In other words, if you're making a dragon, or I still remember Edward Gorey's book, The Wuggly Ump, which is this horrible monster that looks with beady little eyes that eats children, and these wholesome children are laughing and playing, and eventually the Wuggly Ump eats them, and you spend the whole book, which is very short, being terrified of this monster.
Or there's a real life dragon, like in St. George and the Dragon by Trina Shaw Hyman, where this dragon is in battle with the knight, and only he's airborne. And we're so used to seeing the dragon on the ground in the battle in this book. And this time he's airborne, and his claws are holding the horse and the knight in the air. And there's smoke coming out of his nostrils. And below him is this pastoral English countryside with a little river running through it. And she really was able to make it much more dramatic and scary, because there's this wonderful life as usual below and this horrendous battle on top with all the clouds and smoke from the fire of the dragon. And it really emphasizes the action and was chosen to do so.
Do people tend to buy the books that they read as children? I would think that there's this phenomenon of books persisting over generations.
Yes, they're always the classic. Every parent that I know always says this one book I remember, just like you told me at the beginning of the interview, you'll never forget certain books from your childhood. And they do stay with us, and we look for those books. And also, growing up and going to school, sometimes we make really huge connections in school, reading, having readings, being assigned books to read, talking about them. And we find our own titles as kids then to continue that love of reading. And the one thing I need to say to all parents, not to advertise one single book over another, but simply to say, to remember that children's books is probably the last place that a child can go now to be quiet and to be with his or her imagination. Because the high-tech world is so enormous, it's so attractive to them, they love it, it's their world, they're so good at it, but they're bombarded by sound and technical things the entire day. And to remember the children's book, they can take and go curl up wherever they can and be quiet and read it, and make their own pictures and stir their own imagination.
You had a little bit of your own fun in the book with the page numbers, which progressively go from left to right as if it were a flip book or something.
Well, I have to say that I've known of Chronicle Books for a long, long time, and I know the editor, Victoria Rock, for a long time. And when my manuscript ended up on her desk and she took it, I was delighted because I knew they did museum-like reproductions and a lot of museum publishing, as well as great picture books. So I was delighted that my book would be in that with that publisher. I had no idea how good they were in terms of working with me in the design of the book. And they came out with so many wonderful ideas, including the whole setup for the chapters, that we just have the books opened and a picture from each of the artists' stories to be highlighted on the page. And if they'd said to me, we'll have it black, and we'll put white on, I would have said, oh no, black, do you really want to have black? I'm not so sure. If they had said that to me before they did it, and I have a lot of experience in
art. Yeah, you're an art director.
Yes, right. I would have said, I'm not sure. But instead, they were smart enough to send me proofs and ideas visually. And it turned out being, I think, a beautiful book. They did a great job there. It was their decision to do the covers of each book on the end papers, and to do the use the actual frame to frame all of the artwork in terms of the chapters. And then actually in the back, they didn't tell me, but they put a photo of myself in the back, but it was in a frame, so we laughed about that too. So I have a lot to thank Chronicle Books for.
Phyllis Evans is the author of Show and Tell, Exploring the Fine Art of Children's Book Illustration, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe on West San Francisco Street across from the Lenzic Theater this Friday, the 16th of May at 5:30 in the afternoon. Thank you so much for being with us and for writing this marvelous book.
Well, I had a good time doing both. Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with poets Gerald Stern and Anne-Marie Macari. Please stay tuned. And I'd like now to welcome poets Gerald Stern and Anne-Marie Macari. There is an event tonight at the School for Advanced Research with the help of Collected Works Bookstore, a spring poetry reading and reception. That's today from 5:30 to 7:30 in the afternoon. And poet Jill Batson also joins us. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
So this is in honor, Gerald Stern, of your book launch for your book of poetry, Save the Last Dance.
Right.
You've been writing poetry all your life?
Since I was two.
Since you were two?
Yeah, I started writing sonnets when I was two.
Oh, really?
I'm teasing you.
I know.
Because I can't ever answer those questions. When did you write your first poem and that kind of stuff? But I started early.
We just got done talking to a children's book illustrator and have been talking about children's stories and the incredible influence that they have on you. Were you a reader of children's books or of any literature early?
I sort of read everything in the various libraries that I was exposed to, you know, in elementary school and junior high school and high school. And I was, I guess, very interested in adventure stories. And the one book I remember most was a book called Lost with Lieutenant Pike. And this was about the man who presumably discovered Pike's Peak, which is in Colorado. He was the second lieutenant in the American Army, but he climbed the wrong mountain. But they named the main mountain after him anyhow. So I was very taken by that they honored him even though he did the wrong thing.
So this is your most recent book, Save the Last Dance. How did you name it?
There is a poem in the book, which is a little too long to read here. It's called Save the Last Dance for Me. And I originally was going to call which of course is a kind of a hokey, beautiful country song. Save the last dance. You know that song.
Yeah.
Should we sing it?
Go ahead.
Do you sing it too?
Oh, no.
You don't sing?
I don't.
Why not?
Because I can't sing.
Yeah, everybody can sing.
Not on the radio.
then I just called it Save the Last Dance to shorten. So it would fit on the cover. because we couldn't fit that long title on the cover.
It sounds better.
Would you like to read a couple of poems?
Sure.
Your choice.
From that book or any book?
From how about your latest book, Save
It. Okay, I'll do that. Let me find one. Okay. Here's one called What Then? My new style is, if I have a new style, is more in keeping with music, the music of language. So I never know where I'm going. I start somewhere, so to speak, in midair and hope to land on my feet. If I could describe my aesthetics, okay? You know, I know there is just enough light between the boards and that the tree creaked and the branches scraped against the roof, and all I can think about is whether my shoes will be covered with dust when all is said and done, or whether the cake will cover it, and cracked and brittle they rise once again as all shoes rise, both high and dry, if even the tongue is split. And what was called a leather top was loose from its moorings. You know the pain the shoe itself swelling can cause here. How can we rid the world of swelling? That was my first grievance, or muck to start with. Muck was the problem. No one I know should die, but what do my two black shoes know? Let's say a creature will blow them dry by beating his wings on, or let's say we'll walk next time, say, north instead of south. Oh, nearer my face to thee, and nearer your face to me. What then?
We're talking to Gerald Stern. I read many of the poems. Now, I can't say I read every single one, but I read many, many of the poems in your book yesterday. And one after another, I could not understand. They felt like they were almost narratives, but not quite. And I couldn't grasp what the story, for example, in that poem, what the story was or is. I mean, are they to be grasped?
What you're saying is very interesting. Almost narratives, but not quite. And I'm not particularly interested in completing a narrative. I'm more interested in explaining an emotion or encountering a set of conditions that bother me or interest me. And if it happens to make sense, fine. If it doesn't happen to make sense, azegaitis, as we say in Chinese.
For whom are you writing?
For Anne Marie.
Really?
Yes, always. She's my only audience. She's the only one who really reads all my poems.
Well, I mean, I guess the question is if they make sense to you or to Anne Marie, but nobody else. What, you know, I just help us understand how to read your poems.
Well, that's not my job. That's not the job of the artist to help the audience how to understand. My poems, by the way, are very simple and available compared to most of what is going on in poetry in the English language today. Shall I read just one poem that makes a little more sense?
Sure.
And if I tell you a little bit in advance about this, then you can fit the pieces together or connect the dots, as they horribly say. So this reflects what used to happen when I was a kid on Saturday night. My father was away working, and I was there with three older women. My mother, our African-American maid, Thelma, and my grandmother, my mother's mother, who was a European immigrant. And on Saturday night, we made this horrible dish, which my mother called spaghetti. So this lies in the background of my mind as I write this poem. The poem is called Spaghetti. Not infrequently destroyed as bits of paper of no value by the women in my family, namely Ida, Libby, and the maid Thelma, my drawings were gone by the time I was 11. And so I turned to music and led orchestras walking through the woods. And Saturday nights we feasted on macaroni, tomato soup, and falso cheese cooked at 350 degrees, which I called spaghetti until I was 21 and loved our nights there, Thelma, Libby, and Ida. Fat as I was then, fat and nearsighted, and given over to art such as I saw it, though smothered somewhat by the three of them. And it would be 5 years of breaking loose, reading Kropotkin first, then reading Keats, and standing on my head and singing, by which I developed the longing. Though I never turned against that spaghetti, I was always loyal to one thing. You could almost measure my stubbornness and my wildness by that loyalty.
Gerald Stern reading from his book, Save the Last Dance, and he will be speaking tonight and reading poetry from 5 to 7:30 at the School for Advanced Research right here in Santa Fe. Anne-Marie, let's turn to your work, Anne-Marie Macari. Would you like to read some of your poems?
Sure. Do you have any, you have a request?
Well, let's see. I mean, the first one blew my mind.
Yeah.
and several others, but...
You want me to read that?
Yeah.
Okay. This is called Mary's Blood, and Mary is the Mary you think she is. Mary's Blood. It was Mary's blood made him. Her blood sieved through meaty placenta to feed him, grow him. Though Luke wrote, she was no more than the cup he was planted in, a virgin no man ever pressed against or urged, who could barely catch eyes with the towering angel, but felt God come to her like light through glass, like a fingerprint left on glass. Still, it's hard to believe she never wanted to be rid of the thing inside her, wasn't shamed carrying him, the child's perfect head pointing at the ground and rubbing her cervix like the round earth rubbing the thin wall of the sky that holds it. All women reach the time of wanting it out, but not wanting it out, not knowing what's coming, so she must have spread her legs in anguish because what was inside, pressing her membranes for release, was both herself and a stranger. And she must have cried out as the small head crowned, splitting her, her pelvis swung wide, to push him through the wall of this world, till what came from her was a child lit with her own gore, soiled, everything open so her inside was now outside, cracked open. It means mother to crack open, to be rent by what comes to replace her. Such is love, the only way. It was Mary's blood made him. His eyes, tongue, his penis, her milk fattened his legs, made hair on the crown of his head. She grew coal to wrap him and door to come through, and nothing, not even crying, father, father to the warped blue sky can change it.
Anne-Marie Macari, now that, what an incredible representation of Jesus and Mary. I've never read anything like it or seen anything like it.
Yes, I when I first wrote that, I felt sort of shaken from writing it because it really was suddenly, it seemed so obvious after I wrote it. Of course, she's a real woman and she went through a real childbirth. But that experience has been taken away from women and sanitized and idealized. And
not talked about.
And not talked about, and as if she just sort of, as if Jesus sort of popped out and appeared, and she was just, you know, she was this nice little package he came in. And I think it's necessary to bring, to take back the experience of being a woman of childbirth, which in both book, both testaments of the Bible is taken away from women. In the Eve story, it's seen as a punishment. Childbirth is a punishment. Now, I don't think a woman wrote that. And, you know, in the New Testament, it's this idealized, impossible vision of being a woman without any, you know, if you think of Mary or think of all the Madonna paintings you've seen in your life, what a small range of emotion she's allowed. She can't rage at her son's death. She can't be overjoyed at his birth. It's a very, very small range, the small smile, the small tear. That's it. and to bring back the experience of what it's what it's truly about to be a mother became, after writing that poem, which started the whole thing, what drove this book to be. What does it feel like to be in a woman's body? Because women are not supposed to, you know, we're the lesser sex, we're unclean, we're nasty, we do, you know, we bleed every month. And how to bring back acceptance of the female body and really explore what it means to be in the body.
And it's so visceral, and at the same time it's so, and I don't even know what the word is, sort of spiritual and transcendent, what you're doing with that. It's not just the body, it's the whole thing. It's spirit embodied in flesh.
Right. And I think, you know, we're taught over millennium of religious teachings that the whole idea is to escape the body. But if you look closely at women poets, when we write, we go into the body. And in that way, it is a kind, there's a French theorist who says, in order to ascend, you have to descend. And I truly believe that. That it's that you can't just write from, you know, the thin air and rise above it all. You have to go into your experience in order to transform it.
So there are real. I mean, as I was reading these, the two poets, Gerald Stern and Anne-Marie Macari, who were with us today, I really thought of that gender differences in poetry. And while we would like to believe that literature is genderless on some level, no man could possibly have written your book.
Probably not. At least not right now. I did want to say something you were asking, Jerry, about, you know, understanding poetry. And I think this is important for a lot of poets and for a lot of readers of poets, because people are afraid of poetry. And sometimes, for instance, Jerry's been writing for, you know, many, many, many years. And if you take his work from the beginning and read through it, you sort of learn, he teaches you how to read him.
Right.
And I think we don't have in our culture that kind of patience anymore. And it's really important to, you know, for people to know that it's not that poets want their work to be obscure. We want to have readers, and we want people to understand our work. But it does take a sort of self-education as you're reading each person, you know. Would you agree with that, Jerry?
Yeah, I think you're right. You actually, this is true in painting and music as well. And dance, you have to learn, you have to have patience, pay attention, be open, and to what the artist is bringing you that might be new, or a new version of what you know. I've grown a little intolerant of some sorts of fixed stubbornness, where people say, you to the artist, whoever the artist be, whatever field of it, you have to come to me. All is not the artist's responsibility. God knows what who is responsibility or hers is too. But when I encounter new artists, I've done all my life in all the fields, I pay attention to the artist, to what he or she is doing. And I know from experience that I've often rejected the new, what was the new, because I wasn't patient enough or didn't pay enough attention or didn't listen.
But I think at the same time, your own work has gotten more cryptic as you've gotten older, because
I have.
A shorthand at this point.
And let me just read a very short poem. It's on the back cover of this book. It sort of talks about, if you will, my brain, or a brain, or the way the brain works. For what we have here, in addition to a message or a statement about reality, is modulations of the brain. So this poem is called Dream 3. I would like to live on air too, and I have an idea the kind of nourishment I'd get with or without my strings. For what did I need them for? And all those gnarled roots beside the wilted rhododendron. And what did I need the dried out grapes for? And the wet leaves and one harmonica under a rusted burst out water pipe. And even a mangled sparrow under the porch, the way my brain works.
Gerald Stern is with us today. Well, I mean, one has to, in a way, let go of trying to make any kind of sort of linear or intellectual sense of it and go into your work maybe as if it were a surrealistic painting or so I don't even know what visually to compare it to.
Well, also, I mean, I think it's okay to say, you know, to just listen and hear the poem and not necessarily know what it means and take those first impressions and go with it as you would walking in to, you know, and looking at an abstract work of art. That's okay, but people are afraid of that, and we're taught in school, you know, what does this poem mean, and what, you know, what's the symbolism, and what's the imagery, and I think the first thing that we should do is just listen and hear a poem and be with it, and whatever impressions we take, that's okay, and not to feel, you know, bad about yourself if you don't have it all figured out.
Why don't you read a hard poem?
A hard poem. I don't know what I have here that's that.
Well, read an easy poem then. Read another poem.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, read
another
poem. No. I want her to read another poem.
All right. All right. Well, this is a more complex poem. I'll read this. It's called Still Life with Magnolia and Dove. And it's about, I was at some point a few years ago, I had several women calling me up who were suicidal, and one was being in a very abusive relationship, and I was in this terrible place of not knowing what to do and wanting to help, but you know, there are sometimes when people are in that situation, they don't accept help. So that's what this is about, and it goes back and forth between different experiences. Still Life with Magnolia and Dove. She says she wants to leave, except her bones are dissolving in her back so she can't even walk. I know she's not writing these phone numbers down. It's her own story. I have no business. But when she says, I haven't told anyone, I move the receiver from my ear, already knowing what she'll say as she describes her husband's forearm block of wood slamming her head, while outside the magnolia opens flower by flower, each branch bouncing when the petals spring apart. Near my window, the dove turns toward the sun, and the pink streak on its neck surprises me. I'm touched from all angles by pink radiation, heartsick. And just because I once thought I'd die, it's not the same if I ate my own cocoon to get out, swallowed my fetid corset till I stank of newness. Why should she care? Trapped in her bed, dreaming of dying, sky pouring over the tree and the tree still opening. Maybe in time the lost iris of the eyes of Solomon will pluck our orbs from their delirious cradles. Or maybe we need a madness we can cling to. What we learn is never learned enough, which I know when every window in my body hurts to be opened and when I have said too much. What I learn is never learned enough, no matter how close I sleep to the sky, no matter what bird bends over me. It's taken my whole life to get here, a kind of safety she'll have to find somewhere in the cup of occipital bone. She cannot see my bird scratching the dirt, the flowers breaking apart in the light. She has her own story. She's living to tell it.
Anne-Marie Macari. And unfortunately, it's time to go now. Anne-Marie Macari and Gerald Stern will be reading tonight from 5:30 to 7:30 to celebrate the launch of Save the Last Dance, Gerald Stern's book. It's at the School for Advanced Research in Santa Fe, sponsored by Collected Works Bookstore. And Jill Batson has been sitting here very quietly, but she made all this happen. So thank you very much, Jill.
Well, you're
thank
welcome.
You, Jill.
I hope some people come out and see
thank
the
you,
poets.
Mary Charlotte.
And
thank
is
you.
There, let's see, if there is a number that people can call for more information, it's 820-0717.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Stay tuned to this wonderful public radio station, and we'll see you tomorrow. Bye.